From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're seeing signs today that the U.S. economy is weathering uncertainty across the globe. The Commerce Department says gross domestic product grew at 3.7% in the second quarter. That's revised up from the 2.3% growth rate that had been reported last month.
And of course, the second quarter, Robin, does not include the last week. Right. So we'll see what happens with gross domestic product in the third quarter. But of course, stock markets have been seesawing up and down around the world. In China today, stocks closed much higher after a week of wild and deep losses. But as stock prices have been taking swings all over the world, up and down, the price of commodities around the world has been heading pretty much straight down for the past year. And that's where we want to go now. Commodities, of course, the raw materials and foods that are bought in bulk, copper, coal, corn, wheat, things like that. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax joins us now with more on this. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's just look at this generally, first of all. You can pick any commodity you want, and basically it's been going down for the last year. What's been going on?
When we were coming out of that financial crisis in 2008 and 9, global commodity prices took off. I mean, that sounds strange, but really, China had this enormous appetite for raw materials at that time. And pretty much anything that you were producing, they were buying. They wanted to build apartments and factories and those Olympic venues. They needed everything, copper, steel, iron, aluminum. All the prices shot up, and they peaked in about 2011. We were still kind of dragging ourselves out of a recession, but they were booming. But then 2012 came along. China's growth started to cool, and they've been buying fewer of those commodities. The prices started sliding, and the past year has been terrible. They're down across the board about a third. And this has really been tough on miners, drillers, farmers in this country, but especially it hurts people in those less developed countries that really need to sell their commodities like nickel and zinc and all of that. They've been taking a beating.
And they can't just cut back on supply when the price goes down like that?
Well, that's the problem. The supply is really out of whack right now with demand, and there's a reason for that, though. Think about it. When the central banks were trying to pull the world out of that financial crisis 6 years ago, they cut interest rates. That made loans cheap. So people did what people do. They borrowed money. So farmers borrowed money and planted more crops. Copper companies opened new mines. Oil companies drilled. They all started cranking out more of those commodities. And now they can't just suddenly turn it off. You know, look at wheat. It's averaging less than $5 a bushel. Back in 2011, it was $7.50 a bushel. So if you're a wheat farmer today, though, you don't have a time machine. You can't go back. Now you have that new tractor. You bought more land. You've got those loans you got to pay off. So you'll take whatever you can get because a low price is better than no price. So you're going to sell. And, you know, that's the same thing that's happening for oil. So they keep pumping.
But when you have losers in the economy, you also have winners. And I wonder if people couldn't take advantage of these prices and say, let's build more. Let's build more homes while these prices are cheap. Even a government saying, let's throw money into infrastructure.
Well, that's the thing is you always got that other hand. So on the one hand, you've got those farmers and drillers having a tough time, but those cheap commodities mean less inflation. And less inflation means that you can keep interest rates a little lower, a little longer, all good for consumers. I checked on the AAA website. The average gallon of gasoline is now $2.53. That's 90 cents a gallon less than last year. It could go down to $2 a gallon by winter. That's good for all of us. And economists say that on balance, when you look at it all, the cheap energy is making more winners than losers.
And what about a government deciding, let's throw more money into infrastructure, into roads and bridges? Isn't this just the time you'd want to do that?
Well, it does seem like common sense would dictate this is a good time to go ahead with infrastructure projects. You know, you've still got a lot of workers who would like to get those good construction jobs. There's cheap materials, cheap money. All Congress has to do is act on that long-term highway bill that's sitting on its desk. But, you know, when they come back in September, they've got a lot to fight about. There are many issues out there. And it really looks like they're going to continue this fight over how to fund those infrastructure improvements. But really, this is a very good time to be building roads and bridges now that China has cooled off so much.
Marilyn Giewax, senior business editor at NPR. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next story is set in Baltimore, where, as in many cities, thousands of people have lead poisoning from growing up in housing built before 1950. Many of you know there were lawsuits and settlements spread out over time to help the children who grew up to develop irreversible brain damage and other problems after eating the paint chips or breathing the dust. But this week, the Washington Post revealed that many of those children, now disabled young adults, sold those long-term settlements, sometimes for pennies on the dollar, to companies that approached them offering immediate but much less money. Terrence McCoy's story is titled How Companies Make Millions Off Lead-Poisoned Poor Blacks. Terry, give us the overview. This is a big industry, but a legal one, with companies like Access Funding. What do they do?
Well, these companies, there are dozens of them. They come to Baltimore and they look for annuitants, as they're called, people who have long structured settlement payment streams, to be able to purchase all the rights to those streams for what can sometimes be dimes on the dollar.
And why are these settlements spread out over time?
Well, those settlements are spread out over time to try and protect these people who oftentimes are unsophisticated when it comes to managing large sums of money. They'd have no experience with it. And a lot of times they're cognitively disabled.
And so the thinking is if they were given a lump sum, it might be spent in days. This spreads sometimes $1,000 a month payments over years.
From my research, it seems that usually their structure is so about $1,000 per month,
yeah.
And that stretches over decades to try and help that person handle the stresses of their life.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they live for. Well, so these companies approach them, offer to buy these settlements to give them immediate money now. You talk about Rose, a 20-year-old woman who has irreversible brain damage, was receiving those settlement checks from a lawsuit her family filed in 2007. Contacted by Access Funding, what did she say happened?
Well, she says what happened was that they called her one day on the phone and she ended up getting into a deal that she says she couldn't really understand. What it did was it was from 2017 to 2052 and all those payments in aggregate value was about $575,000 with a present value of about $340,000. And in a slew of signatures, she ended up selling off all of that for about $63,000, which comes out to be 20 cents on the dollar or so.
Half a million almost in payments through her lifetime as opposed to $63,000 now. You spoke to Access. What did they say?
Well, their response is that this is an industry that's legal. They're operating within the system. And secondly, it's not – how are they supposed to know? They're not doctors. How are they supposed to know whether this person or that person has any sort of mental impairment?
These companies also say that they fill a need, that sometimes people want to have immediate money as opposed to payouts over time. But I found it interesting that even some representatives of this industry felt that there were problems and it should be regulated more. You write there are supposed to be independent advisors for people like Rose – and judges that sign off on these deals. What's happening?
This is not something that's new. There have been stories of deals that plunder the vulnerable for decades. And then about 15 years ago, a number of states passed a series of bills that were supposed to protect these people and more or less outsource responsibility for deciding whether this is in the seller's best interest to the court system. So what happens is that these deals have to go through the court system for approval. And really this relies – it hinges on these judges to be able to make these decisions upon whether or not to balance a company's desire for profit and what oftentimes is the seller's vulnerabilities.
So those laws were passed, but you write that there are judges signing off on these deals in seconds, and the independent advisors often are frequently doing multiple clients for one company. They don't seem independent.
I did discover that in my research. One lawyer who I discovered did at least 52 separate deals for one company, and that does raise questions, critics say, of a conflict of interest when one attorney is working with one company or working on the same deals that one company is filing deal after deal after deal.
Look, you came to the story through your reporting on Freddie Gray. He was the young man who died after video showed him being dragged into police custody in Baltimore. That video launched riots there. You found that he and all of his siblings, lead paint victims, had sold their settlements. How much total was sold and how much received in that family?
By 2013, Freddie Gray and his siblings started striking deals with Access Funding. And in one day specifically, him and two other siblings – ended up selling off $450,000 or so, with a present value of $250,000 for something like 54 grand. So obviously deals that came out to be something like 20 cents on the dollar.
Rose is filing a lawsuit against her independent professional advisor, the lawyer that advised her. But what's the sense that there might be some change here? What's happening?
Well, what's happening now is legislators have taken notice of this situation. Even before this investigation that we published, there was a growing knowledge that the system wasn't working the way that it was intended to. Yesterday, I spoke to one lawmaker who told me that she spoke to a dozen other Maryland lawmakers who are working on a piece of legislation that hopefully will do more to protect victims of lead paint poisoning and other vulnerable recipients of structured settlements.
Well, and of course, I'm sure people across the country are checking out what's happening in their area as well. Terrence McCoy, investigative reporter for The Washington Post, will link you to his story, How Companies Make Millions Off Lead Poison Poor Blacks. Terrence, thank you.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been talking about immigration on the show, hearing from different points of view. Today, we want to hear from two people who came to this country legally. First, Alexandre, or Alex Gilamberci. He came to this country from Brazil with his parents on a family-sponsored visa. And Alex, tell us when you first came to the United States.
In 1988, when I was 8 years old, our family came to California, and we were planning to stay permanently. That's when my family started the application process for our permanent visas. After the end of that 1 year, we went back to Brazil because the INS authorities had told my parents that our permanent visas were approved, but we needed to go back to our country of origin to wait for them to be issued because there was a waiting period of approximately 5 years, as they estimated it.
But you ended up waiting in Brazil much longer than that.
Yes. So we went back to Brazil and expected to wait for 5 years. And we just kept waiting and waiting. And we eventually got a letter calling us to the consulate to receive our visa 11 years later.
And at any point in that time, did you and your family think, you know what, forget the United States, let's just stay here?
Well, we're very fortunate. I'm pretty straightforward in saying that we had the privilege that when we went back to Brazil in 1989, we were able to resume a steady life. So it wasn't that terrible staying there. So we were just open to any possibility. By the time we were called in 1999, I was already attending university in Brazil. So I had a prospect of finishing college there. My older brother, he actually became unqualified for our immigration visas because he was older than 21 at that point.
Mm. So he was not able to come back with you to the United States?
No. So in 1999, when my parents and I came to permanently settle here, my brother stayed in Brazil, and he is still there today.
Did you ever think during the period between when you lived in California and when you came back to the United States, maybe we should just come in on a tourist visa and overstay our visa and just stay in the U.S.? Do it illegally.
I don't think that thought ever crossed my mind. Now as an adult, I realize that was a very conscious decision that my father and my parents made, knowing that as a professional, he could go back to Brazil and have stable employment, although with a not so great economic situation, would be a better quality of life for our family.
So what do you think about that process that you had to wait so long, get in line, as people say, to get into the United States legally?
Ideally, I think that if people, I don't know, people sometimes talk about how the free market economy needs to deregulate trade restrictions. But it's a little bit of a paradox when we do that, while for immigration, there are so many restrictions. So
it should be as easy, you're saying, for us to move people between countries as it is to move goods between countries.
If the international economy wants for there to be that much of an ease to move goods between countries, there should be the freedom for people to move between countries.
What do you think about people who do not do it the way that you did it, who come in illegally, who cross the border illegally and stay here illegally and work illegally and don't follow the rules?
I think that it is very circumstance-oriented. I feel that I had the privilege of being able to go back to Brazil and go back to a stable life. Many immigrant friends and coworkers that I had in my 16 years of experience living in the United States did not have that privilege.
So you're sympathetic to them?
Absolutely, because I've worked side by side with people that are people just like you and I and are just trying to provide a safe and stable life for their families. And in their countries of origin, they are not able to do that. And if you look at the larger picture of why the circumstances are like that in their countries, that boils down to international economic policy, international trade, and how agricultural policies are set. So when the globalization of our economy creates instability in countries that we are trading with, that's when we have a problem.
So what do you think should be done with the people who are here without documentation?
I think it depends. Some people have been living here already and working and raising children, contributing to the American economy. If you're already a contributor to the American economy, that time should be taken into consideration. If you have already worked so many years, it doesn't matter how have you worked here, but you contribute to the economy. You produced goods. You made this economy flourish. If you are raising children here, people should have the right to stability in their lives. This country is what it is because of immigrants. And the people that keep coming here as new immigrants keep making America what it is.
Alexandre Galimberti, who came to this country from Brazil when he was 20 years old after waiting 11 years for green cards. Alex, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.
And for another view, let's turn to Gopinath Pulyankot, who came here legally as well from India on a work visa in 1999. And pretty soon after, his company sponsored him for permanent residency. But Gopinath, after all this time, you still don't have your permanent residency, right?
At this moment?
Yeah.
Well, the good news is, like, well, after we set up this interview on Friday, I got a letter from the USCIS saying that my permanent residency process has been approved. So
16 years later, you're finally
exactly
getting this news.
That is true. Yes. Yeah.
I wonder if they found out we were going to interview you and they wanted to have a good news
story. That's what I was
joking.
That's what I was joking. My family says I should have done this interview 10 years ago.
Well, let me ask you, over the last decade or more now, was it worth it to you to go through all that trouble to stay in the United States and move closer to permanent residency?
Yes. I mean, professionally, it's definitely helped me grow. And for my children, yes, the opportunities here in the United States are definitely better. But things have changed now. Like 16 years later, on hindsight, probably maybe staying back in India would have been equally rewarding without this having this burden over your head or shoulder every night saying, okay, what if I lose my job or something happens here? I suddenly become out of status and now I have to pack my bags and go. And of course, this whole thing is because of that uncertainty. There are a lot of things in life that we couldn't do. Like, I mean, we still haven't bought a house just because we don't know. Like, what if I get laid off, right? If something happens and my company decides, okay, we no longer have a position for you. Now,
you don't want to put down roots.
Exactly, yeah. So that way, it was pretty temporary stay for this last 16 years, even though from a heart and soul, like, we totally belonged here. I mean, we participated in every opportunity here to see and adapt the culture here and be good citizens, so to speak. But we are still considered outsiders. So
what do you think should happen with the people who are here illegally? Should they have to go home, as some have said, or should they have a pathway to citizenship?
No, I wouldn't send them home, but being here, there should be a process to regularize their stay, right? I mean, the ultimate goal is citizenship, but citizenship is a long process. Even for us, like, becoming a permanent resident is just the first step. Now I had to wait for 5 more years even before I can apply for citizenship. So given that, yes, so people who are already here for whatever reason, if they've broken the law and they have become undocumented, they should be given an opportunity to correct it, right? There should be a process where they are verified. Like, the whole concept of undocumented is, okay, like, you haven't gone through the procedure to be vetted and processed to find out whether you are eligible to be in this country. So they can start that process.
What do you think about the debate, the tone of the debate that you've heard over the last month or so?
Unfortunately, it is pretty polarizing. People always look at the wrong side, because I've heard the debate where people come back and say, okay, if you're going to pardon people who have broken the law by being in this country, then we should also pardon everybody who has a parking violation or who has a speeding ticket, right? I mean, so from a layman's standpoint, both are breaking the law. So again, you know, the way to fix that is you don't deport somebody who has a parking violation or who has a speeding ticket. You go through a due process. You go in front of the judge and plead. And if the judge sometimes hears your story and says, okay, I understand why you were speeding, I'm going to pardon you. The same way, people who have broken the law, they should be able to make that appeal where they come back, come in front of somebody and say, okay, this is why I'm here, and this is why, as per the law, you feel that I've broken it, and how do I correct it?
So the punishment should not always be deportation, you're saying?
Exactly, yeah. Unless there is a, like, I mean, there could be cases where there's some violent criminal or something. But again, that is a due process situation. Somebody has to be proven guilty to come up with that extreme decision, right? Yeah, like you come back and say, okay, this person is not worth having in our country, kind of a thing.
Gopinath, how's it going to feel to you when you finally are holding that green card?
At this point, it's almost like a milestone that we say, okay, we finished that. There's one burden less from our head, so we are looking forward to the next one, which is finally trying to become a citizen. So it feels good. Definitely it feels good. It's been a long, painful wait. So, in fact, today morning when I was just talking to my family, I was asking the same question. How does it feel? I mean, technically it feels no different, but it's at least we see a brighter days ahead. So it's definitely one less thing to worry about.
That's Gopinath Pulliankot, who has been in this country since 1999. He came here on a work visa. He's been waiting for his permanent residency, and it looks like things are finally coming together. Gopinath, thank you so much, and best of luck.
Well, thank you. You're welcome.
And after the happy news that two pandas were born to the giant panda Mei Xiang at the National Zoo in Washington over the weekend, some sad news that one of them has died. Brandy Smith is the Associate Director for Animal Care Sciences at Smithsonian's National Zoo. And Brandy, very sad, but was it expected that both of these cubs would make it?
You know, when you have twin giant pandas, we know the mother can't raise them herself. And so we know we need to step in and help. And anytime you add kind of more variables in the system, there's more room for risk.
Why can't the mother raise the two cubs herself?
What we noticed with Mei Xiang was when that second cub was born, she had a difficult time picking it up. So she has one of those tiny little cubs on her body, and whenever she would try to pick up the second one, she would drop the first, and then she would try to pick up the first. So we wanted her to be able to successfully focus on one.
And is that something that you could say about pandas in general, or is that Mei Xiang specific?
We do know that when a panda gives birth, there's a 50-50 chance that they could have a twin. And we do know that there are very, very few cases of a mother panda successfully raising two cubs on her own.
Hmm. And what you were doing at the zoo in order to try to help both of these cubs survive is you were sort of trading off with Mei Xiang. She would take care of one and you would take care of the other.
Yes, she would have one on her body, keeping it warm and nursing it, feeding it. And then we would have the other in an incubator, keeping it warm. Originally, our goal was simply to swap the cub so that she would just be feeding them both. But then we found out in terms of weight gain, we wanted them to gain a little more weight. So we began supplementing.
Did she show any concern about the smaller cub?
No, and there was no difference between larger or smaller cub. What we noticed is whatever cub was on Mei Xiang, she cared for that cub fiercely.
Does Mei Xiang now know that one of the cubs is gone?
I don't think so. She would have one cub on her. There came a point when we could put the other cub on the ground in front of her squealing, and she would just ignore it. So she would focus on whatever cub she was breeding, and that second cub she didn't have any interest in.
And do pandas mourn once she does figure it out? Do they mourn?
That's a bigger question than I can answer, and I hate to be anthropomorphic. When you talk about fitness, it's about reproduction. It's about producing offspring. So I don't think she knows what happened.
So now with the surviving cub, what are the chances for that cub to grow up and be a giant panda one day?
that cub is doing so well. You know, it's loud, it's active. You can see it's making Meishong work to take care of it. So it seems to be doing really well. And right now we're mostly just monitoring from afar. So we're not taking that cub off of her. We're not putting it in an incubator or supplementing it. We're letting Meishong take care of that cub, and we're just doing what we can to help her.
And when does that cub get a name?
Tradition is usually 100 days, so I think that's what we're thinking right now.
And any ideas of what it'll be?
No idea.
You know, parents never tell you before they finally give the kid a name. I don't know why that is.
Well, you know, if Meishong has an idea, she hasn't indicated anything to us, so we're not sure if she has something in mind.
Well, Brandi Smith, Associate Director for Animal Care Sciences at the National Zoo, we're sorry for the loss of the smaller cub, but hopefully the bigger one will do just fine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Secretary of State John Kerry, former FBI head Robert Mueller, 13 U.S. ambassadors, 3 Pulitzer Prize winners, are all graduates of St. Paul's, an elite prep school in Concord, New Hampshire. But the school is now under a cloud because of the trial of another former student, Owen LaBrie, accused by a fellow student of raping her when she was a freshman 2 days before his graduation in 2014. And the trial has revealed a long-standing tradition at the boarding school, kind of a hookup competition. Paige Sutherland, from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio, has been following events. The trial went to the jury today. And this warning, her details may be upsetting to some.
This so-called tradition at St. Paul's Prep School in Concord, New Hampshire, is called the Senior Salute. Seniors try to hook up with as many underclassmen as they can during the last 2 months before graduation. The meetings range from seniors showing younger students a secret spot on campus to kissing to having sex. State Prosecutor Catherine Ruffles argues that on May 30th of 2014, senior Owen LaBrie, who was 18 at the time, took the Senior Salute too far and forced himself upon a then 15-year-old freshman female student in a secluded building on campus.
They did not have sex together. This was not a consensual act.
The alleged victim, who testified for more than 8 hours over the course of the trial, told the jury in vivid detail how a consensual romantic encounter escalated beyond her comfort zone. She described how the defendant continued to pull down her underwear and try to take off her bra despite her efforts to stop him. She told the jury she was fine with LaBrie kissing her, but didn't want it to go any further. But LaBrie wouldn't stop. She said when LaBrie raped her, she didn't kick or yell, she just froze.
I feel like I injected as much as I felt I could at the time. And other than that, I felt so powerless and weak. And I couldn't do anything else.
LaBrie has testified that he did not have sex with the accuser. He admits that he invited her to meet up with him that night as part of the Senior Salute, but says he stopped things before they went too far.
I had a second thought while I was looking down at her and, you know, trying to put on the condom. And, but we'd had a good time. But it just didn't feel like the right move.
When LaBrie was arrested shortly after the alleged rape, he told police that his accuser was too young and that he was, quote, not that type of guy. During the testimony this week, LaBrie described how at St. Paul's he was captain of the soccer team, had a leadership role on campus, and graduated summa cum laude. He also talked about his plans to study theology at Harvard after graduation. But also this week, several of LaBrie's friends testified that LaBrie bragged about having sex that night. And prior to the incident, LaBrie wrote online about, quote, slaying and scoring with girls for the Senior Salute and referred to the months of April and May as Slaybril and Slay. J.W. Carney, a high-profile defense attorney who represented Boston mobster Whitey Bulger, is defending LaBrie. He argued that the alleged victim thought LaBrie was a cute guy and that she was the one who wanted to take things further, but LaBrie stopped it. He also told the jury that being invited for a Senior Salute was something prized by younger students.
The girls would be honored and proud about this, that they were the focus of a Senior Salute, that a senior had thought that this girl was pretty enough or interesting enough to be the subject of a Senior Salute.
Carney also questioned why it took 5 days for the alleged victim to report the incident. And when Carney pushed her on why she waited, the 16-year-old girl broke down.
Well, why were you cloudy?
I was raped.
Officials at St. Paul's declined to comment on the senior salute tradition, but said in a statement that, quote, allegations made about our culture are not emblematic of our school or our values, our rules, or our people that represent our student body, alumni, faculty, and staff. Jury deliberations are underway. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Sutherland in Concord, New Hampshire.
Well, the St. Paul trial comes during a national discussion about consent on college campuses. And there was a sidebar talk this week about how freshman girls are being welcomed on college campuses. You might have seen the crude signs, crudely hand-painted on bedsheets hanging from the Sigma Nu fraternity house at Old Dominion University. Rowdy and fun, hope your baby girl is ready for a good time, and freshman daughter drop-off with an arrow pointing to the frat door. A frat at Ohio State had a bedsheet banner that read, "She's called you daddy for 18 years, now it's our turn." Some students said the signs were sexist. They mocked sexual violence against women. The National Sigma Nu fraternity suspended the Old Dominion local chapter. But the Ohio State students defended their sheets. One said, "I'm a good Christian, we're just having fun." Let's check in with Scott Jasek. He's co-founder and editor of Inside Higher Ed in Washington. And Scott, what are you hearing from schools in this debate over the bedsheets?
Well, I think what's interesting is that people have finally noticed. Old Dominion was not the first university where fraternities did this. Many have been doing it for years. What's happening right now, I think there is increased awareness of traditions that may be offensive to some, demeaning to others, encourage inappropriate behavior, and people are more willing, I think, to speak out about it.
Well, as you all know, there's a healthy debate. Adrienne LaFrance writes about this in The Atlantic. She points out that her colleague Connor Friedersdorf writes, "How do we reach a place where a local frat makes crude jokes, causes the BBC, CNN, The Washington Post, and USA Today to spring into action?" In other words, there are people who are saying, well, this really isn't that big a deal. It's just guys having fun. We should concentrate on what's really important, which is that there is a rape culture on college campuses. Although some people, like Adrienne LaFrance, think they're connected.
I think they may well be connected. I mean, it's certainly true that First Amendment gives us rights to say what we want, particularly at a public university, and some of what people may say may be offensive. At the same time, I think it's reasonable to say, what are the attitudes that are encouraged by certain behaviors, such as hanging those sorts of banners? And what kind of message does that send both to a woman who's enrolling and also to a man who's enrolling about how to see fellow students?
Well, and we just heard about the culture at the private prep school St. Paul's, the senior salute, the tradition of seniors trying to hook up with as many younger girls, some of them underage, as possible. Do you think there's a connection?
Well, I think there's a connection in lots of traditions that people think of as being in good fun that, in fact, aren't in good fun for everyone. Now, I don't know if that one student raped another at St. Paul's. I've just been reading like everyone else. But that tradition seems to have been around for a long time, and nobody did anything about it. I think it's the same with the banners saying things. I think it's the same with traditions like some universities have hostesses that entertain male athletic recruits, mm-hmm. but not female athletic recruits. What kind of message does that send? Likewise, there's a huge debate right now over statues of Confederate heroes on campuses, mainly in the South. I think people are paying more attention. Now, there's a lot of criticism of it, with people saying, oh, students are being coddled and they're stomping all over the First Amendment. But in many cases, what we're talking about is what free speech proponents advocate, which is countering speech with more speech. What's wrong with people saying, hey, I don't like that tradition. Hey, that tradition demeans me.
No, we know. We just reported on how freshmen in particular going to orientation this summer are sitting through long lectures on consent. What exactly is it, yes or no? How much will what we're talking about be picked up, do you think, by colleges in this orientation? I mean, people are saying, how can you get across that to make women part of a bedpost notch count is an objectifying, broad brushing all young women and treating them like, you know, bowling pins, you know, to be knocked over. How much are colleges maybe even using this to address those concerns?
Well, I think it's important to separate out multiple issues. There's a set of issues around sexual assault and rape that are legal crimes. So you have a set of orientation activities around sexual assault, particularly because in several states, the laws of consent have changed. And so they need to teach students about that. I think in terms of non-illegal behavior, it's sort of a battle of ideas and people speaking out. I think in many ways, the most effective advocates for not saying and doing offensive things are fellow students saying, you know what, that's not funny.
That's Scott Jasek, co-founder and editor of Inside Higher Ed, speaking to us from Washington. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and a new Chinese action musical has been drawing crowds at its U.S. premiere in Denver this summer. Terracotta Warriors 3D is a live performance centered around the story of China's first emperor who was buried with an army of clay soldiers. As the name implies, the show unfolds in 3D, and it's part of an effort to spread Chinese culture around the world. Corey Jones from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports.
I've seen 3D movies before, but not a 3D musical at the theater. So I'll admit, I flinched when a dove flew right at my head during a preview of Terracotta Warriors 3D. So did Kathy Hudson.
A dove, like everybody else.
Hudson says she's never seen anything like this.
I saw the smoke. I saw the leaves on the trees moving. It's just so realistic. Even though you may not totally understand what's going on, you're just locked into what you're seeing on stage.
It's a wall of 2,080,000 light bulbs behind 50 live dancers.
That's Dennis Law, the show's writer and director. He says all those tiny LED bulbs create a 3D effect. And there's more than just birds coming at you.
Arrows, tree branches sticking at you, rain, ghostly figures.
Law grew up in Hong Kong with a passion for the arts. He retired from being a surgeon in Denver years ago to produce art. A foray into Chinese martial arts films opened the door to create what he calls action musicals. They meld elements of Chinese performance art and Broadway musicals. Think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon meets West Side Story. Law first staged a 3D version of Terracotta Warriors in Beijing last year. And he says it uses new technology developed in China.
I was able to put together a show that I really believe is first in human history. To deliver a 3D experience in a theater stage has really never been done before.
Terracotta Warriors 3D is the story of China's first emperor of the Qin dynasty. This is back in the 3rd century BC. Qin was a ruthless leader who united China through war. An army of terracotta warriors guarded the emperor's mausoleum. This story is told through the eyes of the ruler's eunuch and close friend. Law imagines the eunuch served his emperor with loyalty and resentment.
It's much more than a story of a powerful emperor, somebody that tortured people, killed concubines. We must understand the reason behind this historical figure.
The production is flashy and elaborate, like the opening ceremony at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Law says he hopes the extravagant 3D effects entice more American audiences to see the show.
I really think that cross-cultural understanding between the East and the West is an important thing, and I create these musicals so that the West can appreciate Chinese art and culture at its best.
Recorded music and live drumming throughout the show. There's also Chinese opera, acrobatics, and dancing. Nearly 50 Chinese dancers flew in to perform along with some Colorado artists.
Push your leg up.
Just look like this.
Okay.
Josh Allenbach rehearses his role as a peasant who fights against the emperor. He says it's a challenge to work with Chinese dancers who speak a language he doesn't understand.
At first, it's nerve-wracking. I'm pretty sure there might be a few things that get lost in translation, so that's the biggest problem for me.
Allenbach dances with the Colorado Ballet. He says in his role as a peasant, he's had to learn to move in a casual way.
That's kind of what I'm trying to do, like switch from being at the ball to being at like a party with friends.
Chris Creator Dennis Law says the Chinese government is involved in Terracotta Warriors 3D. He won't say to what extent. I made repeated requests to speak with Chinese officials, but Law only provided a vague email response. However, Law claims his show does not have a political agenda.
I'm not pro-America as far as art is concerned. I'm not pro-Chinese. But I can help the Chinese authorities realize what aspect of Chinese art and culture that Americans will come to see.
And Law hopes to do that with Terracotta Warriors 3D. He sees the production fitting in with China's ongoing global cultural push. Clayton Duby directs the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California. He says China envies the worldwide influence the U.S. has with Hollywood and its music industry.
And China would like to replicate that.
As for Dennis Law, he hopes to one day take Terracotta Warriors 3D back to China as an example of how the country can expand its global reach. For Here and Now, I'm Corey Jones in Denver.
Sounds like an interesting show.
Who would have thought?
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.